subject, particularly in the genetic aspects of this. So.
Where have you been working?
I've been an independent consultant for over 10 years in healthcare.
My name is Tua Rutianen, and I just started the MBE program, and I'm kind of interested in this because my mom's an OBGYN, so I've heard a lot about some of the issues, and I don't know, I'm really looking forward to learning more about it, so that I'm headed for med school after finishing the MBE, hopefully.
Okay.
I'm Caroline Cuff. I am a hospital chaplain. I work at Mankato Rehab, and I take this class because I'm really interested in this subject, and especially in issues with stem cells and spinal cord regeneration, and issues of selective abortion for fetal abnormalities.
I'm Chelsea Switzer. I'm brand new to the MBE program. I was a philosophy major, and I studied a lot of ethics in college, and most recently, I taught preschool, and I dealt with a lot of families dealing with issues with reproduction, so just made me curious.
My name's Dave Polk. I'm a full-time MBE student this year. I took a year off of Jefferson Medical School after my third year, so this is the second half of my program. I'm interested in kind of combining future and emergency medicine with some undergraduate medical education.
So you can contribute to our discussion today on the scientific issues. Yes, go ahead.
My name is Allison. I'm a dual master's student in social work and public health. And I took this course just from experience. I worked in parenthood for 3 years and family who works in the field.
You worked where for 3 years again?
I worked for Planned Parenthood.
Okay.
I've been a research coordinator at different places for the past couple of years, mostly in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And this just sounded like a really interesting course.
I'm Caroline Morris. I'm a senior at Villanova University. I will start this program full-time in the summer, and I have a background in biology and gender and women's studies.
I'm Amy Barenbaum. I just started the MBE program full-time this semester, and I'm planning on law school, really interested in health law and policy. And my mom is also an OBGYN, and so I feel like I've grown up hearing about these issues and want to look at them from a more academic standpoint.
I'm Natalie Boitin. I'm a first-year med student here at Penn. I am very interested in ethics in general and reproductive issues in particular. And I'm not actually, so
registered.
I've been going from class to class
okay.
since I was trying to take, so
okay.
I'm not actually a
right.
registered yet.
Natalie.
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Pepe. I have a background in genomics, and I'm interested in the class because of the overlapping issues between reproductive ethics and genomic sciences.
Let's see. Let me pass out syllabi for those of you who don't have one. I went over the syllabus last week, so I'm not going to go over it step by step today. Here, just put this down here. Whoops, I think I may have handed out my own. Just, do any of those have writing on them? I must have left mine in my office. So. There's an extra. Could I look at it? No extra, that's all right. Basically, I'll go over some of the, a few points from last week.
I should introduce myself. I'm Kathy Taylor. I teach here at the center. I am a lawyer. In my previous life, I practiced law for about 8 years, and then I went in the healthcare field. Then I went back to school to study bioethics, and I took a long time to get my PhD, and I finished in 2006, and I've been teaching here since 2007. I teach ethics in the pharmaceutical industry, and I teach this course, and ethics and reproduction is really my major area of interest, as well as perinatal ethics, which is kind of related, ethics in OBGYN. And we will be covering some of that. I think that's often left out of ethics and reproduction courses, but I like to focus on the maternal-fetal relationship issues as they arise in trying to regulate the behavior of pregnant women, and also as they arise in perinatal ethics. So we will be spending a day or two on those issues. I lecture some, but I really like to have a class that's mainly discussion. I encourage everyone to participate. Part of your grade is class participation, which includes speaking up in class, but also attendance. But I'm not strict. I mean, I'm not taking roll. if you're gonna miss a class, just let me know. And I think I'm very welcoming of everyone to speak up in class. So I encourage you, the class is as good as the discussion that we have in class. I don't think at a grad level that you need to be hearing me lecturing. I think that we need to have a discussion. These issues can sometimes be a little polarizing, and I'm not sure whether we'll have those diversities of opinion in this class or not. We may very well. But I think that we all just need to be sensitive to each other's beliefs, respect different sides of the debate, and respectfully disagree. I mean, we're not here to just agree with one another. We're here to discuss these things from all sides. Are there any questions? Oh, and I assign, this is all discussion that you guys got last week, but I really want to give it to the people who are new. I assigned 3 papers, 2 short argument papers, and a final paper. The argument papers are 3 to 5 pages. I believe that's what it says on the syllabus. Does it say 3 to 5 or 4 to 6?
3 to 5.
And they don't require independent research. I just want you to make an argument about a particular issue that we've discussed in class up to that day, the due date of the paper. They are due on, I don't have my syllabus.
February 23rd
and
March 30th.
Thank you. And then a final paper, which is 15 to 20 pages, which is like an argument paper. I want you to take a position on an issue, state your position, develop it, talk about counterarguments, how you would respond to those, and then conclude. So I'll send around a brief description of the papers by next week of my paper requirements. Mainly, I just want to see that you're thinking about these issues, especially in the shorter papers. You know, I don't want a report. I don't want just a summary of someone's argument. I want you to think about your position on a particular issue and tell me what that is and why you disagree with those who argue on the other side. Okay? It's just kind of an exercise in writing and in presenting a position. And the final paper is due May 8th, I believe, but I'm not strict about that deadline. I just put it down there. Some of you, whoever may be graduating, probably need to have it in by then for sure. Others can have it in by then, or later. I don't know when grades are due exactly. Probably not for a week after that, but so anyway, it's not a drop dead deadline. Okay. Any questions about the class or anything I've just mentioned? Today we are going to discuss the moral status of extracorporeal embryos. I have a PowerPoint I want to start with, and then we can move on to our discussion. Let's see. Yes. I will. So you don't, yeah, so you don't have to copy these. All right. Sorry. Set this up. There we go. Now, what are extracorporeal embryos, and why is this why are we talking about this issue? I know that the answer's up there, but what's the relevance of this? I mean, we're obviously reading about this every day in the paper almost. Obviously this has to do with human embryonic stem cell research. The status of that, it has to do with this moral status of embryos that are in storage in IVF clinics. Any embryo that is outside of the body is an extracorporeal embryo. And they can be created, in an infertility clinic through IVF or also through a somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is essentially cloning. You take nucleus from one cell, put it into another cell, and jumpstart that cell to start developing as that new entity with that same genetic code. And there's been a lot of discussion in the stem cell research arena about why embryonic stem cells are so desirable, because there are many who do research in adult stem cells, hoping that these types of cells can also have the same kind of promise that embryonic stem cells do. Embryonic stem cells are pluripotent, which means that they can become other types of cells. Any of you that have anything to add to this scientific discussion, please contribute, especially those of you who work in this area. Liz, did you have a question?
I was just going to say, to make it sound simpler, embryonic stem cells have been divided between 2 to 8 times. I'm clear, but the adult ones have been divided more 8 and above, so then that...
You mean an embryo or the stem cell?
The actual stem cell, because each time they divide, they become more specialized, and that's where you run into the problems of the variability of what you can make each into.
Once they become more differentiated, then they're not able to become other types of cells.
And even later stage embryonic stem cells in development are more differentiated than your... Mm-hmm. Initial ones.
And you want a less differentiated tumor.
You want a, right. Yes. Because the less right. differentiated, the more you can make into. So the earlier, the better.
Mm-hmm. And there has been research done, just this past year or 2 years ago, on using skin stem cells. What is that called again?
Induced?
Yes. Go ahead.
They use a viral vector to make a shift in the regulation of the genome so that any epithelial cell can become a stem cell.
So there is some promise in other types of stem cells besides embryonic. However, There is argument that that science is not well developed, and also that they will still need the embryonic stem cells to compare to the others. I mean, we still will have a need for embryonic stem cells if we want to do this kind of research. And the research has, of course, been slowed due to lack of federal funding, which we're about to discuss. But this year, FDA gave the go-ahead to Geron for a phase one trial for embryonic stem cells for spinal cord injuries. So that is the first trial that's been approved using embryonic stem cells. And if I were giving this lecture a year ago, or even 4 months ago, I would have been able to say, and we know that this is just the beginning, but we're about to discuss why that's not the case. Just a history of embryonic stem cells. They were isolated in 98 by Thompson, Wisconsin. So, you know, that's a pretty new, relatively new technology. In 1995, before they were isolated, the Dickey-Wicker Amendment was passed. Well, it was put into the HHS appropriations budget, into NIH appropriations. It prohibits federally funded research in which human embryos are killed, destroyed, put at risk. So once we had isolated these stem cells and were able to do the research, the question became, does the Dickey Amendment prohibit this kind of research? Until last July, Clinton administration, Bush administration have both found that the Dickey-Wicker Amendment did not prohibit embryonic stem cell research as long as they used already derived stem cells. So as long as the funding wasn't to actually create the cell line, the funding wasn't used to actually to fund the research that actually destroyed the embryos, once the cell line was created, then it can be used in federal research. In 1999, the National Bioethics Advisory Committee had come up with a report with a middle ground position on this issue. The issue is, where were they going to get these embryos? Could you create them in a lab for research, or should we only use already created embryos that are, quote, spares in the IVF clinics? So they began to promulgate guidelines on this issue that spare embryos in clinic could be used as long as they met certain requirements of informed consent from the donors of those embryos, the gamete donors, and as long as no inducement was paid to get those embryos.
Actually, I have a question about the IVF stuff. Are IVF clinics federally funded?
No.
They cannot be because of this amendment, correct? Or
well, they just don't. They just aren't. They're private clinics or clinics in academic medical centers or whatever. That.
So they receive no governmental money whatsoever?
Well, the patients might, but
they could be paid for, the service could be paid for by Medicaid or Medicare.
Right. But Medicare is not generally going to be.
Not generally, but there's some subpopulations that it might be. But
yeah. So but the clinic is not run by the federal government.
No, I know. I was just trying to see, because, you know, the whole controversy is over these embryos. And then, you know, if you're doing the IVF, if that's federally funded, isn't that kind of.
Well, it's not.
Or if somehow the government was putting money, somehow money from the government was going to the IVF clinic in some indirect route, you know, wouldn't that be?
Well, they might get grants to do research in reproductive technologies, but it's not really a, you know, or the patients themselves could get the federal funding.
Okay, because they didn't really talk much about the IVF clinics with these a spare embryo topic, things and money and that sort of.
Right.
Do you know, do you see where my thought process is going?
Corbett, did you want to comment on this?
I have a question
after this discussion. Oh. I guess I'm not sure what your question is. I mean, are you asking whether Dickie Wicker would apply to funding of IVF research?
Not IVF research, like, I don't know. I guess somehow I would assume that some government money would fall in the hands of these IVF clinics, maybe. And if so, would this amendment have the same stipulations as it has on this embryo research? Yes.
Yes. Okay. I mean, the problem is that they don't have a federal tie to the IVF clinics. I mean, many of those who are opposed to embryonic stem cell research are also opposed to IVF or to destroying the embryos created through IVF. But no one's about to try to pass a federal law saying you can't do IVF. So the only reach that they have right now to impose that view, which is what they've done, is the Dickie Wicker Amendment.
Okay.
You essentially say you can't do research on embryos. I mean, you can't fund research that actually destroys the embryos. Corbett.
I just want to make sure I heard. So Medicaid or Medicare can reimburse treatments of IVF?
In theory, if it's a covered benefit, they could. It depends on the different states' regulations.
Right. I mean, Medicaid... I mean, some states require private insurance to cover it. In terms of Medicaid, I'm not sure if there are any states that actually require Medicaid to cover IVF.
I mean, that's also assuming that a doctor would accept Medicaid, which a lot of doctors don't accept Medicaid for a variety of services anyway. So.
Medicare would be for those people who had disabilities who would have Medicare coverage. I mean, not many people using reproductive technologies would have Medicare in the first place. Was there any other questions? In August of 2001, right before 9/11 actually, and this was kind of like after this happened, there was a lot of discussion about Bush and embryonic stem cell research, and then 9/11 happened and it was completely off the radar screen for obvious reasons. Bush made a national address on this issue and said that from then on federal funds, it limited the stem cell lines they could use. They would only fund lines that had already been derived up to the date of the announcement. And really the rationale for this is that they just didn't want to encourage the further destruction of embryos. They allowed funding of research that was using stem cell lines that had already been created, but they weren't going to, they felt that if they funded more, they would be like encouraging the destruction of more embryos. There have been a lot of criticism of this position. After this policy was put into place, there were only like 22 stem cell lines available that qualified, and several of them were questionable quality. And therefore, private research has really been the driver in this field. Yes?
This may be simplifying, but like I have no biological background. A line of some is, I mean.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I just want clarity if the whole class is going to be.
Who wants to explain that?
The lines.
Mohammed?
Yeah, actually lines mean the cells that can be stored and subculture over and over again. Actually, cell lines is actually immortal cells that can be stored over and over again.
So once they derive the stem cells, they just keep on replicating. And so that's a line of stem cells that they got from one embryo.
But with a consistent set of DNA in that line.
right.
Set of DNA per line.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So my question then is, if they're immortal and they keep going, because I first saw 22 lines available, and I thought, that doesn't sound like that much, especially if there are some of questionable quality. But they can keep going over and over again. So isn't it sort of like a money tree? Or just
but it's not an issue of the number of stem cells. It's a question of quality of the line.
Okay.
So there's some question.
Don't the lines degrade over time? Like, the more times the line going, like, the more times you pass on each new generation, like, the DNA can get damaged and stuff just by time.
Okay.
And how we can get cancer.
Or whatever, over, okay.
They're immortal in theory, but in practice,
okay.
There was also some question about the fact that they were being cultured in mouse cells and whether they could be, that could somehow affect their quality. I don't know. Some of the scientists in here could probably speak to that a little better.
And basically, if you consider 22 lines representing like 22 sets of DNA or 22, let's use the language of 22 individuals. This is like an underrepresentation of patients and an underrepresentation of the general population. So
if genetic variability.
If you want to create significant research to help most people, you have to get a larger sample from the population.
Okay. Did anybody else have a comment on that? Thanks for asking the question. After Obama's election, they lifted Bush's restrictions on what stem cell lines could be funded. However, they continued the what they interpreted as the Dickey Wicker requirement, which was they couldn't fund the creation of new lines, essentially. And they charged NIH with broadening the funding and to issue guidelines on stem cell research in terms of what lines could be used, what kind of consent should be obtained. And by the way, you can look at these guidelines. I put them on Blackboard. They're the National Academy of Sciences had issued a report on stem cell guidelines during the Bush in 2005, I believe, and NIH has also built on those. So there are guidelines online in Blackboard that you can look at. They issued the guidelines in July. I'm sorry, that should be 2010. 2009. Or maybe it was 2010, I'm sorry, because right after that, a lawsuit was brought by some researchers claiming that Dickey Wicker prohibits funding of any kind of stem cell research. The language of Dickey Wicker is no federal funds for research in which a human embryo or embryos are destroyed, discarded, or knowingly subjected to risk of injury or death greater than that allowed for research on fetuses in utero. Let's just talk about destruction or discarding right now. So again, this had been interpreted as saying, well, we're not going to fund the research that actually destroys the embryo by deriving the stem cells. But once that's done, we can fund research on those cells. So these two researchers, one from Harvard, I believe, and the other, I can't remember where they were from, sued in federal court claiming that, number one, they were being harmed by this policy because they are actually researchers who do research in adult stem cell lines. So they claim that this was harming them, it was harming their research. They were joined by a Christian adoption group that wants to adopt embryos from IVF clinics. Let's see. There was a lot of litigation about whether they had standing to bring this lawsuit. The Christian adoption groups were thrown out of the lawsuit, but it was found that the researchers did have standing. This case was argued in front of the D.C. Circuit in December. Looking at the lower court found that Dickey Winker prohibits any kind of research on federal funding of any kind of research on stem cells. If that were the case, there will be no federal funding of stem cell research, period. I think that that's a strained reading of the statute, and it certainly goes against what you could argue would be the intent of the drafters or the intent of Congress since, but we'll see what they do. The plaintiffs are represented by groups, and this is political and religious and moral views about what is the moral status of an embryo. And they argue that embryos are human beings, and that using embryos that are frozen in IVF clinics or embryos that are created for research purposes is the same as killing a human being. Therefore, we get to the question of what is the status of these embryos. Before we discuss that, does anybody have any questions about background, general issues? This has been a very skeletal discussion of embryonic stem cell research history, and yes?
I wasn't familiar with the Christian adoption group, but I'm just wondering out of curiosity, once they adopt an embryo, what do they do with it?
They gestate it.
Oh, okay.
It's people who believe that, you know, and people are, you know, this is happening, that some infertile couples who haven't been able to create their own embryos have been getting embryos from others who have extra embryos in agreements between couples. Some IVF clinics kind of have this program where they will do this, but these groups essentially want to save these embryos from destruction. The embryos that are frozen that won't ever be used. And therefore, they want to adopt the embryos. They want to give the embryos to people who want to gestate them. So that was their argument, that they had standing to bring this lawsuit. Any other questions about this background? Okay, now I'm not going to lecture anymore. Really, this is a pragmatic political question. It's now a legal question as to whether this research is going to go forward. But there have been two bioethics committees that have looked at this issue. The National Bioethics Advisory Commission under Clinton, and then Bush's Presidential Bioethics Commission, in terms of what is the moral status of these embryos. So I've given us three readings that represent members of Bush's commission, which was a relatively conservative bioethics commission headed by Leon Kass, who's at Chicago, who was evidently instrumental in talking to Bush about what his policy should be on embryonic stem cells. He subsequently became the chair of Bush's bioethics commission. And they came out with a report on the issue, which now will be shelved because there's a new administration. But these readings, I think, really nicely discuss the positions of the various views on this issue. So there are essentially three different views. Well, mainly two major views. One is that the embryos have the same moral status as human beings, as we do. And the other is, I mean, some argue that there's no moral status at all, that these embryos are like other types of human tissue and should not be accorded any type of special respect. The intermediate view is that there is some level of moral status such that we should treat them with special respect. So why don't we begin discussing those then? Let's go first to the Robert George and Patrick article. Well, no, first we'll go to Sandel, because Sandel and McHugh were published first, and then George was responding to those articles. So Sandel and McHugh were both published together in the same New England Journal of Medicine volume. So what are Sandel? Sandel essentially offers two arguments in support of using these embryos for research. What are his arguments? Yes.
He essentially
says... Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm going to do what we did last week. Can you just say your name for the first class or two? We'll say our names before we speak so we all get to know each other's names. Go ahead.
I'm Amy. And he essentially says that while embryos don't have personhood, personhood isn't the only thing that merits respect. And they still, to some extent, should be protected, but not to the same extent as a person would be.
And why are they not persons?
He uses the analogy of an acorn and an oak tree. That was him, right? And he says that while there's a continuous development from an embryo to a person, they're not the same kind of thing, and you wouldn't react the same way to an acorn being destroyed as a whole oak tree. And
Well, let's start with that one, because that's a big argument, that they're essentially different in kind. They're not the same type of being. Any agreements, disagreements with that view, expansions on it?
Yeah, I have a hard time seeing them as, I had a hard time with this whole thing. I have a hard time seeing an acorn as a tree, just as I have a hard time seeing an embryo as a person. Thank you. I was like, what's that word? I like when he says human life develops by degrees, but I don't even think, embryo, like, acorn, tree?
Mm-hmm. I tend to agree more with George and me. I just don't think they're analogous. I mean, a tree and a person. I mean, we don't give trees the same status that we give people.
You agree with Sandel.
I think it was George and Lee, wasn't it, who give full moral status to them?
Well, yeah. They're saying they're different
sure.
in kind.
Probably,
yeah.
Yeah, I just don't think they're analogous.
That's
not
a fair analogy.
Sandel,
yeah,
I just don't think it's a fair analogy to give a tree the same moral standing as a person. For many reasons, the tree is not a rational being and will never be.
I don't know that an embryo is. See, that's where I start getting iffy.
And I think if a tree was of the same moral standing as a person, we would treat the trees differently. We would treat animals.
Maybe it's just a bad analogy.
I mean, I don't think that he's saying that a tree is equal to a person. I think he's not saying like tree equals person. He's saying that acorn is to tree as embryo is to person.
I don't think it's a literal.
No, I realize that, but I think you cannot, even if an acorn is the beginning of a tree, you can't treat them the same way. I mean, just because an acorn represents a small
you know, the beginnings, or not even the beginnings, the very beginning of a tree, just because you don't give it the same status. I mean, it's just not analogous that you would treat the same things, even though they are analogous. And yes, that's the fertilized seed and it becomes this. That doesn't mean you should treat them the same way.
Well, you're right. I mean, Patrick and Lee, George and Lee argue that this is a wrong analogy. And that's one way that they are trying to argue with Sandel, and saying, you know, we don't see a tree as the same as a person. We may admire a tree, we may admire its beauty, but it doesn't have the same kind of intrinsic moral status that a human being does, and therefore you can't analogize trees, acorns and trees, with embryos and people. Okay, you've had your hand up a while, you as well, Dave and Liz. And go ahead.
I guess,
and what is your name again?
Oh, Caroline.
Caroline.
I think that my sort of question with Sandel, he seemed to be grounding his argument in, you don't get upset when an acorn gets crushed, but the way you get upset the way a tree was felled. And I think it's sort of a faulty argument when it's applied to people, because the way that we've conceived personhood as humans is constantly changing and expanding, and if we can see, and it used to be like for some, you know, if you're an Orthodox Jew, you don't see a newborn who's between 0 and 8 days old as fully a person yet. So if you're going to ground it simply on the emotion of, I'm not saying this right, sorry, but I should probably stop. But I'm thinking that the way that we see, actually go to somebody else because I'm not formulating it right, sorry.
That's all right, you made some points there. Yes, go ahead. What is your name?
I'm Jane. I guess my problem is, I think it's Sandel's real idea is that, you know, they are different in kind. Unfortunately, the analogy doesn't then translate because it opens the door for, as it George and Patrick to later be like, well, if you have this analogy, then you've got this sapling, and you're going to compare your sapling to an infant. And so, you know, you can think of them as different types of things, but the analogy just doesn't work. I mean, because it's just semantically opens the door for other arguments that can come in.
I felt like that was the most convincing argument against Sandel's position, was to take his analogy out and to fill in the gaps, because there is a continuum. The least convincing argument I found against him was when they were trying to establish, I think it's kind of what you were speaking to, but it's kind of hard to put down because they were talking about the inherent virtue of the human. And they were trying to establish exactly what that was and why it set people apart from trees. But what he finally boiled it down to was not that people are necessarily rational or have rational capacity, but they were conceived in rational nature, which to me makes no sense. It's just an abstract thing that has no real grounding, because if you are yourself not rational, such as a retarded person or a demented elderly individual, I don't understand exactly what he meant by rational nature.
He. He as in?
The, I think, who said this? It was not said, it was
George.
George, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because we have it going back and forth here between,
That very much confused me, and that, I think, is a real weak spot in that argument, because everyone has this inherent, a lot of people have this inherent feeling that humans are somehow different, but it's really hard to put that into words.
Than animals or
trees. And I think that for a lot of people, that is a basis and a major requirement for saying that an embryo has special value. You first have to say that a human has special value. But to really be able to express that in concrete terms and words that are non-religious are very difficult.
I don't know who is next. Oh, Liz, who are?
The main conflict, I think, I'm on the side of Sandel in the sense that I think he kind of looked at the argument in a very parsimonious, very simplistic manner, and he was just trying to explain the one thing, you know, the acorn, the analogy there, in a very, you know, general population manner. But I think the topic that was missed by both the pro and the con of the argument is, you know, the gestation and the environment as to which the embryo needs to be in to become a human. And when comparing it to the acorn and the acorn tree, like, the acorn needs to be in, you know, this really nice dirt environment with nutrients, just like the embryo needs to be in the womb and needs to gestate. So, you know, they kind of miss this whole skew here of this environment that both the acorn and the embryo need to be in to become this, you know, role of magnificent, this a value being. And I think that there might be the topic, which I know the third article,
Nelson talked about the potentiality.
The potentiality, which I think might be kind of the thing we need to focus on rather than, you know, the magnificence of this, that, and the other or whatever, because if you don't have an embryo gestating in a womb, it doesn't become like...
It doesn't have any potential.
It doesn't become the baby that you think it is. And an acorn, if it's not in the dirt, it's not going to become the acorn tree.
But, I mean, by that argument, you take a baby out of a loving home or out of any home, and it's not going to become a person either. It's going to die within a few days without food and warmth and shelter.
Yeah,
so it's the same environment. I mean, a baby loses the same potential to be a rational being that an embryo does.
Or a newborn.
Exactly, a newborn, a sapling, if you want to do the acorn example. I mean, a sapling's not going to make it either in the wrong environment.
But the environments are different kind that you're talking about, right? I mean, the sustenance of a womb or the earth is required for it to even be born. Once they're born, certainly they need sustenance to be kept alive. But, I mean, the response to that would be your environments are different. Once they become a newborn, a separate set of moral considerations can come into play, or some people argue they would. Some argue it's exactly the same. I really have no idea who's was up, so you guys can kind of decide.
I'm just responding to that specific point. I think that's sort of like withdrawing or withholding life support. You know, like, it's like kind of a different debate where, like, the baby's already born, he would be, like, withdrawing nutrients versus withholding them altogether. So that's where I would draw, like, it's a different argument, I think. But anyway.
I kind of wanted to go back to the acorn analogy, because I feel like while we can pick apart how much it really applies to humans, I think the point that it was making is valid. And I think the point is that just because an acorn can become a tree, acorn doesn't equal tree.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
while an embryo can become a human, an embryo or person, an embryo isn't necessarily a person. And I think he goes on to explain it more. I think that was the purpose of the analogy, and the New Atlantis one, I think, really just picks apart something that wasn't even being said in the first place.
Well, they're kind of approaching it from a different direction, Pepe and then Carolyn.
Actually, it goes even further. If you take potentiality as the basis for the assignment of any kind of moral status, now with the technology of induced stem cells, any epithelial cell might become yourself, and you will be given, I'm just exaggerating the argument, but any cell from my finger will have the same moral status as me. Obviously, we'll need also the environment to develop into a stem cell line, and that stem cell line should be implanted and gestated to become a clone of me, and that would make a different kind of discussion. But the potentiality argument is a very tricky one in that sense, in the sense that now we, almost any cell of your body can become a copy of yourself.
Well, and George really calls it the continuity argument, you know, but let's finish with the Sandel acorn tree and other arguments about whether we really value embryos the same or not, and then go to potentiality continuity.
No, actually, this was to favor the acorn tree analogy. I mean, it's not the same a cell from my hand, a cell from my hair, that me. So it would be making the same mistake as assigning the same full moral status to embryos and to persons to assume that, I'm not going to exaggerate it, to assume that a simple sperm or a single ovum has the same moral status as a fully developed person, because they have the potential to develop a fully developed person.
That's a very standard objection to the argument that potentiality equals moral status. Yeah, because there are a lot of intervening things that need to happen.
I think I know what I meant to say first, and I always lose stuff like that. But I think what I was trying to sort of think about Sandel's argument is he seems to say that we intuitively think that the loss of an acorn is different than the loss of a tree. And I guess what I'm trying to thinking about is the argument of what we feel about a loss really say anything about the moral status of what's lost? And what I'm thinking about is a woman who, like, there are three women and they're all 8 weeks pregnant or something, and one is desperately hoping for a miscarriage, like she doesn't want to have the baby. One woman has absolutely no idea she's pregnant, and the other woman is dying for a baby, like she's very excited about the pregnancy. And those, but is the embryo itself in each one of those women different in itself, or is it just the response to it that's different? And does that response say anything about what kind of thing is inside of her? So that's, I think, what I was trying to say. And I think that would also go with, and maybe this is kind of jumping forward, but the intention. Does intention determine worth? Because thinking about different women, and one of them is pregnant and wants to have this baby for a great purpose, or, you know, raise it and love it and do all that, and another woman has some kind of evil intention, you know, she wants to get married to have, I don't know, a little sleep or something. But do we care less? I mean, does the intention determine what, does the intention determine for which it was created determine how we should think about protecting that which is created?
I think you make a good point, because Sandel really is making arguments about moral intuitions to an extent, and I think he makes a good point, but I think it needs to be developed more. We don't see an acorn the same as a tree. Because, I mean, and it's just counterintuitive, I think, to give them the same moral status. And then he argues that, and I'm not quite sure, you know, how to characterize this argument, but he essentially says, and we don't, if you really valued these embryos the way that you do, then why aren't people running out trying to save all the embryos that are in the IVF clinics and whatever? In other words, he is making an appeal to how we emotionally feel about these embryos as conferring status in some way. But not just Sandel, but many argue that, yeah, of course, you know, embryos or fetuses have moral status. And then they go on to say, it's a person to me, you know, say a pregnant woman, or some other pregnant woman decides, well, I don't want to have this child. Do those two different embryos or fetuses have different moral status depending on how we feel about it? Can partiality towards an entity, love, caring, does that confer moral status? Or is moral status something that's intrinsic to the being that... is growing, whatever you want to call it, whether you want to call it a person, a child, an embryo, a fetus. And that's a very big point in ethics. So that's a good point to bring up. Dave.
Just to what you were saying, what Sandel was saying, why aren't people upset about the embryos and IVF clinics? And my thought was there are a lot of people upset about embryos and IVF mm-hmm. clinics. That's not like an ignored thing, but much like it's not acceptable for, you know, it happened more in the past, but people would go to abortion clinics and kill the doctors. I mean, there are certain dictates of society that, you know, make people not rush into IVF clinics and take all the embryos. So yeah, I think he kind of glossed over that unfairly a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But also,
mm-hmm.
Amy, right, to your point, I kind of agree that he sets up the possibility that acorn does not necessarily equal oak tree, as embryo does not necessarily equal human, but I don't think it necessarily proves the reverse of that, that embryo does absolutely not equal human. It opens the possibility for it. So to me, I think that does not a tremendous amount of actual like metaphysical legwork. It just opens the possibility for that statement, which is fair, you know.
I think it just says that potentiality alone.
Right, and that's fair, yes. Yeah.
Let's go to the continuity, what George phrases as taking continuity seriously. That's on page 4 of the New Atlantis article. What is his argument? What does it mean to take continuity seriously in George's view?
I mean, his was the argument about the sapling, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Just make sure I'm not getting these confused, okay? So basically just one of his arguments was if we're going to take continuity seriously, we have to include, as we talked about before, different stages, not just the initial fertilized and the end result, but all stages in between, and also variations of the individuals. So we may favor the grandness of the adult oak tree, but do we offer less moral status? But we don't necessarily favor a decaying old oak tree. So then let's take that over to the human side. Do we offer less moral status to an old person who's in a wheelchair than we do a young athlete?
And also a degree of development.
Right, so the sapling argument that we talked about,
right.
Do we offer less of a moral status to a child or infant than we do an adult? As he suggests, we offer less of a preference for the sapling to the adult oak tree. But I do think that is where the difference can be made in the analogy is, you know, we're not assigning actual moral status to any of the oak trees. We're assigning some kind of like. And this, I don't think, was delved into greatly, but that's what I saw. You might like a professional athlete more than you like an old person in a wheelchair. I think that there's a lot of people who actually probably do that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're offered a different moral status or any different rights.
Well, and therefore the argument is, you know, the essential nature of human beings is such that we intrinsically value each equally. Their argument is that the embryo has that same kind of intrinsic value because it's just got to go through its phases of development, and then it will, you know, so you can't draw a line between a blastocyst and a 2-month fetus and a 4-month fetus and a newborn and a teenager. You know, there's no way that you can draw that line. So therefore you essentially have to value the embryo to be consistent, the same as a born human being. What are you gonna make?
Oh, I was just gonna say, you know, he clearly explains like the embryo has direction on what it's gonna be from just the fusion of the sperm and the ovum, and then I guess it's saying, he was claiming that his argument for the continuity is you know, it has directions on what to become. It's got the same genetic makeup of everyone here. And then the third is that it's a complete whole organism, no matter if it's immature or mature. And that his that was his basic argument of saying that, you know, you can't really pick a time period in the development of an embryo, fetus, whatever you, what stage you want to call it, and give it the moral status. It should be given the moral status at the actual, you know, fission of the sperm and the ovum at that time point because of these three criteria there.
Actually, two of three of the three arguments he is proposing can be easily refuted. I mean, the second one, the embryo, the embryo is humans and it has a genetic constitution and epigenetic primordial characteristic of human beings. That again, I could say the same about any cell of my nose, and it would be, and I won't be giving any moral status to my nose. And most importantly, the embryo is a complete or whole organism, though immature, not necessarily, because it can develop to have an encephaly. It can develop to be bradydactylian. So it's not necessarily just because the membership to the Homo sapiens species directly stands that it will be a complete and wholly developed organism. And even if you go a little bit back into the development, you cannot even be sure of its existence naturally until it has implanted, because most of the fertilized embryos do not implant into the uterus. So,
and in fact, pregnancy is defined at beginning at implantation, not conception. Yes.
Two things. That was, I guess, that was where I started to kind of have issue, because I don't know enough science-wise, but I saw that piece with those 3 points, and I thought, well, couldn't you just bring in someone who thinks otherwise? It's like in a courtroom, someone says, no, this is this, and then you bring in the other expert who says something completely different. But I thought it was really interesting when Sandel talked about, well, if you want to talk about implantation or embryos lost, then you'd have this massive health crisis about all these embryos from pregnant. I thought that was such an interesting point. Like, we shouldn't be focusing on that. We should be focusing on everything. It just kind of,
the epidemic of
that line about, like, it would be a public health crisis about all the, you know, it made me immediately think of that.
But I think that's where intention actually really plays a part.
Yeah.
Because, like, I think that's the sort of difference between, like, somebody who's getting it, who needs their leg amputated because it's got an infection or something, and me chopping off their leg out of spite, kind of, because in that case, like, if you had that sort of, that's a loss, and that's, there's probably something evolutionarily that we should be losing some of these things in pregnant, you know, we shouldn't all be pregnant all the time getting, and some of those eggs that don't implant may not be able to survive genetically to any stage of pregnancy, any sort of viable stage of pregnancy, versus intending, versus going out seeking to create embryos and destroy them, I think is different than sort of the natural loss that happens, like shedding skin cells, kind of.
Well, let's talk about that point briefly, take a break, and then come back on the other article. Should there be a difference, a moral difference, between destroying embryos that are created for research? I mean, between using these embryos in embryonic stem cell research, those created specifically for that purpose, which the feds have said, no, we're not going to use those, or the ones that have been created in IVF clinics and are being stored and will be discarded if they're not used? Why is there a moral distinction, and why or why not?
Well, one of the, I forget which article, but they, one of them said that they are physically indistinguishable, the two. So you could swap them and never know. And I feel like because of that, there shouldn't be a distinction between the two. It's sort of, I feel like it's kind of an all or nothing kind of game. And I don't think you can tease out
Can you, I can't hear you
very
well.
I don't think you can tease out between the two because they're indistinguishable physically, so I don't think, at least in this case, the intention of why they were created really matters, because you're still, it doesn't matter like how you create a wrench, it's still a wrench, and it still does what it does. Like.
But if you oppose the research period, you're going to see that distinction as being irrelevant, because you're going to say they're both have equal moral status, and that is consistent. But why would we care about this distinction at all, aside from that view? Why, if somebody, say, takes the middle ground and would prefer that we use spare embryos than create embryos for the purposes of research, Dave?
I don't have this entirely played out in my head, but if we were to take the premise that wasting, like intentionally killing an embryo is wrong, just to assume that for a moment, then the research that takes the embryo is, you know, wrong. That's just what I just said. But then the people who take these embryos for IVF, some people who agree with my original premise would say that those people are actually wrong, because while it may not be a full, the intention, it is a very well-known consequence that
you'll
is
have
going to happen. However, just as we don't throw away the things that we learned from Nazi research, we kind of treat them as learned knowledge, even though they were contracted through immoral means. This immoral process has already taken place, so why not try to make the best of the situation and use these things that would otherwise be wasted for good?
So even someone who believes in the George view,
mm-hmm.
you're saying, could make that distinction,
yes.
based upon the fact that essentially they're going to die anyway,
mm-hmm.
assuming it's going to be discarded.
Right.
Is it okay to use it for research? And you're saying that George could say, well, yes, because it's going to be discarded, so let's get some good out of it. What do you think George would respond to that? Because I don't think he'd agree with you. But I think that's a good point. I mean,
having assigned the moral status, you know,
right.
he has to, I think he would say that, you know, no, the moral status is there. You can't just willy-nilly treat them as research objects at this point. They should be implanted back into someone, I think, is probably the end game for him, although that has its own set of issues. But.
Or maybe given a proper burial. I mean, and I say that somewhat facetiously,
yeah,
but
no,
some
no,
actually
no.
believe
yeah.
that, you know, this should be treated as a person, that the embryo should be treated as a person. I'm going to take yours and anybody else on this particular point, and then we're going to take a quick break.
Liz. I think in your remark to him about, like, what would George's, you know, opinion be on this, and I think that, like, the means and his idea, well, actually, in both, you know, you have to figure out, do the means justify the ends in this case? And in George's standard, like, in George clearly plays out here that the means from, you know, either a baby created in IVF, I mean, the ends, either a baby created in IVF or some remarkable scientific research that has been discovered, does not justify the means of getting to that point. So, you know, I don't know. I can't really fathom him, you know,
right.
justifying tweedling or dwindling in this middle ground, saying, you know, if they're already here, let's use them. No, like, he's kind of stronghold on this means does not justify the ends there.
Right. Any comments on that?
Well, couldn't you say that it is a difference in kind, because in creating embryos for research, you're creating human life in order to destroy it for another purpose, versus IVF, where you're creating life to hopefully create it, but you know there's going to be some, you know, there's extras, and then you sort of, you deal with the extra, but you're not creating to destroy.
So the intention is attached to a moral responsibility, and if you intend to create an embryo which you know will be destroyed, that is an additional wrong, really, under that view.
But with IVF, I mean, aren't you still creating with knowledge that you're going to destroy? If typical IVF procedures are to create so many embryos that there are, I mean, it's like well known.
It's very foreseeable.
If you participate in IVF or other, like you know there's likelihood of multiples, mm-hmm. or you know that you're probably going to have leftover embryos, and there must be some consent or some kind of information gone over with IVF patients explaining that to them. So there's still intent. I don't know if it's intent to destroy, but it's like knowledgeable intent to conceive with additional understanding that there's gonna, if you consider an embryo a person, that you'll also be destroying, you know.
Well, and
it could be.
Those who see the embryo as inviable either want to reduce the number they create, or there have been cases where women have serially, you know, had their embryos implanted because they had extras and they felt it was their obligation to carry those embryos, well, to try to carry those embryos to term.
Is that like the Octomom?
No, that's like 19 and counting.
Octomom, that's an interesting.
Wait, so the
I mean,
leftover?
She decided, you know, she had 8 embryos, and, well, I'm not sure how many exactly she had initially, but.
I don't know. She was crazy on Oprah, though. Sorry for the
she
side note.
Wait, can
that
I just ask, so there are women who, I didn't know that, so there are women who, they have leftover, and those are.
I mean, that's not very common.
No.
I mean, most people, but some people feel that way. That would certainly be. I mean, many women who felt this strongly about the status of the embryo might not even pursue IVF or would probably try to create 2 and have 2 implanted, you know.
There yes. More and more clinics now will only fertilize the number that you would want implanted, so their success rates are
right.
A lot lower and they don't even have to deal with these issues. That's becoming more and more of a trend.
Right. Let's take a quick break and come back to look at Nelson and tie up some loose ends. We're going to solve the problem when we come back.
We're going to make the world a better place.
Yes, we're going to solve this problem of the moral state. Why is this
feel
not
like
stopping?
This makes me feel like
nothing.
Okay, now you're being recorded.
No, no.
Let's go ahead and get started again. I wanted to bring up the issue of continuity, potentiality are really kind of different. How are those different, actually? Talk about potential versus continuity.
Sorry, what was the question?
Does, you know, a lot of people who argue for the moral status of, for embryos being accorded the same moral status as us is that they have the potential to become human beings. George and Lee kind of tweak that a little bit. They don't talk about that. They say continuity. Why? How is that different? Why would they use that instead?
Well, I think continuity is just kind of stating that, you know, it's all or one in this. You can't really pick a time point in, like, the embryology, development, whatever the words are, to pick when you're going to, like, say, well, now at week 3, this embryo has moral status because, you know, it has the development of the nervous system or it has a heartbeat or something like that. I think that's the continuity argument, because it's either you have one side of the argument saying, you know, it's all or nothing, and then you have another side of the argument saying, well, you know, this should be when. And then I think the potentiality argument is the sense that, you know, well, this fusion of the sperm and the ovum, this embryo, has the potential to be this being, this person, what, you know, whatever. So I think there's a lot of confusion on.
Well, they're very similar. I mean, they feel the same, but in some ways, they're not really the same thing.
I think when you're looking at these arguments, you kind of need to like dissect like
take one and put it over here and then take the other one and put it over here. Because potentiality, you know, if you're going on that route, then every sperm that is ejaculated in the world and, you know, every so-called egg a woman has, it has potentiality to become this so-called embryo. So in reality, we need to be very, you know, conservative on what we do with our
gametes.
And then the continuity argument is, you know, an opinion on where you think life starts. And
that's a good description of the difference.
And just to add a little bit more to her opinion, continuity is like the real life phase of the potentiality argument, because you can have an embryo that has potential to become a human, the fully developed adult. But in the continuity argument, you embrace all the other things that also need to be there so that the embryo can fulfill its potential. You need a continuous nurturing environment, the womb, unless they develop some kind of machine that does it without a woman. And
And I am interested in this potentiality argument, because I do get bothered, this is something that Liz brought up before, about talking about embryos as if they developed in thin air somehow, or as if we could just put them into a machine, you know, some kind of incubator, and grow them into people, into newborns, into neonates. But we can't. And the reason is because women have to carry them to term, and they don't just carry them, they gestate them. It's an activity. It is an action. The women are not just passive receptacles for an embryo to grow in. And I feel like a lot of times this argument about the moral status of extracorporeal in embryos ignores the fact that there is one big factor that's missing here, and that is, where is this embryo going to be gestated? And Larry Nelson and the authors of the other article bring up this point, and I rarely see it written about, that you could argue these embryos have no potential, because until they're implanted, I mean, they have no potential until they're implanted. And therefore, that arguably, according to that view, would affect their moral status. George wants to get around that, or does get around it, by arguing that, you know, in his view, it's continuity that matters. That, you know, given the environment, it is a separate organism that can grow into a person given all the right conditions. But under this other view, it's not really a separate organism until it's born. And yes.
That to me gets into the issue that I think we may talk about next week in abortion, which is, where do you draw the line? And you know, abortion keeps backing up as to viability of the fetus. And what if they invent something that you could just put the fertilized embryo in this little test tube and it will grow and you don't need to gestate somebody? So you then become very technology dependent in that way of looking at it, and technology will change your moral compass.
Well, and that would address one of the major arguments for having legal abortion, is that women should be able to keep their bodily integrity intact and decide whether they want to lend their body to gestate a fetus or not. If they didn't have to do that, then obviously, that would do away with that objection. There are others, such as people have, some argue that they have the right to decide if they're going to be a parent or not. But then that would apply to both men and women, not just the woman. So, were you going to? Oh, I didn't know if you had your arm up. Did you? What is your name again?
Allison.
Okay.
But that's just kind of questionable, because the pregnancy still starts in the woman's body. Like, it's in,
yeah,
in term, I mean,
I guess we're not going to get into that this week, but like.
I guess I'm talking about some situation where it didn't, you know. If, as long as it's in the woman's body, I think that they have the bodily integrity argument to make. I mean, you're right. I mean, in the real world, how would this happen? I'm not sure. Probably just people who wanted to have the child but couldn't for some reason or chose not to would, well, they wouldn't have to. You could create the embryo, you know, and it could grow outside of your body completely if that ever happened. I certainly wouldn't doubt it someday, but.
I don't think it would be that outrageous to think that a womb could be created externally.
Well, I think people are working on that already.
See, that's what I mean. Like,
I'm
yeah.
an alien.
There's
yeah.
some crazier things going on in science
right.
besides
yeah.
the development
oh, yeah.
of a, you know, non-natural womb.
So
they're starting with the heart.
Excuse me?
They're starting with the heart.
What do you mean?
They're trying to
heart.
Develop an outside heart.
Yeah. I've seen like developments of like different heart band, like yeah, they're doing some crazy things. Yeah, it's cool, very cool.
Well, I want to go to the Nelson article because I think they offer one general theory about moral status. That, as they argue, and I think correctly, neither of these views really have. Well, I guess you could say George has a more developed theory of moral status than Sandel, but I think the general theory of moral status offered by Nelson and who's the co-author?
Meyer
is, you know, a plausible one. People may disagree with it or disagree, but
I actually have one question about the George article, like compared to the Sandel and this one we're talking about. Did anyone else find like the Sandel article and this one we're going to talk about like in a more serious manner, and then this George article to be kind of sarcastic in a sense, like making fun of these you know minority I guess you know opinions for I don't know maybe it was just me. I just thought
no, I mean George is a very. You know, he's very sure in his opinions, and he's a very strong writer, so, but no, I didn't find it to be.
Oh, maybe.
But maybe, you know.
Maybe it's just me. I was just curious in the sense that, like, you know.
Can you give some examples of what
right, he was, like, talking about mentally challenged people and, like, a you know, he was just talking about arguments that are touchy in that sense, but he was writing about it with such confidence, I was like, ooh, you know, this could be taken in the wrong direction. And I was curious in the sense, do people that, you know, kind of side with this opinion always write in this manner? Because it was it's an overtly confident piece where he's like, I'm right, and, you know,
that's his writing style.
So I was just curious.
Yeah,
if
I mean,
the,
he's an advocate. He's very active. He's at Princeton. Does anybody know Bobby George?
I just met him a couple of times.
You did?
I don't know him.
Yeah.
Is he, like, overtly... I mean,
he's
I was
just, like, very opinionated.
Like, because I just was curious to see if, you know, you got these people in the room, like, are they, you know, their characteristics have to be extremely interesting, especially
it's just,
like, by
like Kaplan from a polar opposite style. Like,
got
he's
it.
Just very, like, into his opinion, and it's not... I don't think he was being sarcastic in the article, but it just comes across really strongly.
Yeah.
He's the one he's the one of the Princeton dinner? Princeton Penn dinner?
Yeah.
Oh, who's one what?
The person that with Art Kaplan
yeah,
organizes
for like
Princeton
undergraduates,
Indiana.
Yeah.
Oh, I've yeah. always wanted to go to one of those because I live
really
in Princeton,
fun.
But I haven't had the opportunity.
Kaplan.
I still don't know what you're talking
I'll
about.
Have to, Art organizes some kind of a dinner with some people who do bioethics at Princeton.
Oh, okay.
Well,
and undergrads, I think.
The Undergraduate Bioethics Society.
With them, and then people from this program, I think. And Robert George is one of the people who goes because he does this kind of work.
But actually, what surprises me is that when Art once talked about, okay, parenthesis, when Art once talk about the, no, it's okay, it's okay.
No, but I just, oh, no, it's on. No, I was gonna, I wasn't gonna turn it off.
I mean, it's not secret. It's not secret.
No, no, don't worry about it.
He said that they were very interesting dinners because the most liberal in Penn, him, and the most conservative in Princeton. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and now that you mention it, I just clicked.
Yeah, well, he's he was on the CAS Presidential Bioethics Commission. He is a leader of the, I believe it's the Anscombe Society there, which is like a, well, besides that, I mean, he's, yeah, he has conservative views. But, you know, very valid views from that point of view. So he has written a lot on this issue. Yeah, I would like to meet him. Mesa, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just saying, I think the style might have something to do with just writing to an audience. Like
you think?
Just trying to write to a certain audience. The other two are trying to be more scientific.
Right. I mean, this was
journal,
in the New Atlantis.
Exactly. The
and that's a very good point.
You're not going to get accepted into the New England
right.
Journal of Medicine or Journal of Bioethics writing in that style.
Well,
it, so.
Right. Well, some people might anyway, but you're right. I mean, he's trying to, he's writing to a broader audience.
Yeah.
I think a broader audience would be right that way.
Yeah. So let's talk about Nelson's theory of moral status, which kind of borrows a lot from Marianne Warren, who's written a book on this issue. So what is the first principle of moral status? Well, there are four central principles. Corbett.
There's moral agents, more human community, life and sentience, and then ecological importance are the four principles.
So how do these fit together?
Let's see. So moral agents have the highest degree of moral status. And then human community is sort of like the idea that if you're like part of the species or you're part of the community, then you still
mm-hmm.
sort of can get moral status, moral, become a moral agent because you're an integral part of that society. That
right.
Because
so persons who are incompetent for some reason or not, or unconscious or in a coma and or PBS have the same moral status as people who are active moral agents. Yeah, go ahead.
And then there's life and sentience, which is the idea of if you have sentience, then you should get at least some kind of moral status simply because of, suffering is bad and suffering should be avoided. And then there's,
so this would include animals. And, yeah.
And then there's ecological importance, which is like the relative importance of the ecosystem. Like forests have sort of moral status because if there were no forests, and global warming would be crazy and that would be bad. And then we would all suffer or something like that.
Right. So there's kind of a degrees of moral status here. And moral agents, he never actually defines that. But how would you define that? Or does he define it somewhere? I don't see it right here, but I can't remember. I mean, those would be persons
like
who...
the ability to have self-autonomy.
Right.
Sort of like that
mm-hmm.
is sort of what a moral agent is, but not sociopaths or something like that.
Well, and a thin account of autonomy, you know. I mean, able to make choices, I would say, able to think consciously. Well, and newborns would fit under that, moral agents or potential, or maybe he would put them under human community. But that would be problematic from many other perspectives. That would kind of be a Peter Singer type analysis, which I actually heard him almost retract at a conference last fall, an abortion conference at Princeton. And let's go into this evaluative respect and accommodation corollary. because this is relevant to the embryo status. To a reasonable extent and in concert with the other principles, moral agents should honor one another's sincerely made attributions of moral status out of respect for each other. Now notice he didn't say reasonable attributions of moral status. He said sincerely held. So we couldn't say, well, you accord embryos full moral status, but I don't think that's reasonable, so I don't have to honor that. And I don't think, I mean, what does this mean, this corollary, and how is it relevant to the embryonic stem cell, embryonic, to the status of embryos? How does he apply it?
To me, this was the bridge between a intellectual ethical argument till how he gets to the real world. And he basically says, you know, reasonable human beings may differ. We need to find a way of accommodating differences, come up with a solution that everybody can tolerate.
So in terms of embryos, what is that? How does that play out?
They have some kind of status but not equivalent to a moral agency. They kind of fit on the spectrum but not at the highest level.
Mm-hmm. So they deserve some kind of special respect, which is the usual term that people use for embryos, but not inviolable protection.
And what I actually liked is the example he gave a few pages later about the Devil's Tower.
Excuse me?
The Devil's Tower. The Native Americans that consider that the tower has a big moral status, but anybody else, any person from the city would consider that to be just a rock. But we have managed to accommodate their beliefs in order not to, I don't know, climb the rock on certain times that are sacred for these persons. So why cannot we accommodate different views on the ethical debate of stem cells in such a manner?
Now, how would George probably respond to that, this kind of concession? I think as Melson sees it as somewhat of a concession to the view that embryos should be afforded full protection. I mean, if you believed that, how would you respond to this kind of argument? I mean, I think I would say, well, thanks for the bone, but
it's not good enough.
You're destroying them, and that's what I care about. And how can you respect something that you're, how can you say you have special respect for something and then still destroy it? But can you?
Well, I think in, you know, George kind of chooses to respect what he wants to respect in the sense of, like, human life rather than, you know, you take the Native Americans' view and you respect all inorganic living things, including a rock or whatever. So I think if you were to go to George, you know, say you are trying to get this continuity, this respect for all of these embryos, then you need to respect everything, you know, in general, like a frog's embryo or anything that can be living or would be considered living. To
George would say that?
No, I'm saying right. That an argument towards him would be like, if you are, you know, saying you want respect for these embryos, then, you know, what's your justification for not giving respect to, you know, let's say these other species of embryos or, you know, down the pyramid, this rock? Because, I mean, in that sense, you would be kind of looking at everything as a living entity. So, did that make
But what does Nelson say about that? I mean, he would have degrees of status based upon, he would distinguish between those.
Well, I mean, Nelson would
beings
be,
and
be
things.
In the sense that it's an ecological importance, maybe, or it's a lower rank status, but, you know, you can't pick and choose what has, everything should have status.
Well, this is a Singer argument.
Yeah.
Which I'm not I mean, some people say that as a way to belittle it. I'm just stating a fact. Peter Singer says that, you know, sentience supports moral status.
Yeah.
That animals, you know, should be treated with the same kind of respect or almost the same kind of respect as human beings. Arguably, that's more consistent. If you're going to accord moral respect to a living being that can feel pain, or, well, embryos wouldn't be fit that last criteria, but that it's a form of speciesism to say that only humans get special moral respect. But it's kind of like a separate argument. And Nelson would place them in different categories, which I think is consistent with our intuitions about this, about the difference between humans and animals. I don't think that George's argument is consistent with most persons' intuitions on the moral respect of embryos, but why would our intuitions matter? The way we feel about an embryo versus a person, I think most people, if there were a house on fire and there were an embryo in a petri dish and a child to save, which one would they save? And, you know, and there's equal opportunity to get to either one, but you could only save one. I mean, I think we do have intuitions about that there is a difference between embryos and human beings, but when you try to enunciate it in a moral theory, it's very difficult sometimes to do. At this conference that I went to in Princeton, and this really has to do with abortion, but Frances Kissling, is anybody aware of this conference that they had on abortion? I don't know if anybody here is active in the abortion debate, one side or the other, but Frances Kissling, who's going to be coming to speak to us, who used to be head of Catholics for Choice, organized this conference with a Catholic theologian from Fordham and had people who were working, trying to cross a divide on the abortion debate, those who were very pro-choice, those who were very pro-life under all circumstances, persons in between. Anyway, there was a debate between Joseph Fiennes, who's a philosopher at Oxford, who's one of the fathers of natural law theory and the more conservative view, often associated with Catholic view of morality and of the status of the fetus. So he's on the right. Peter Singer was on the left, who has said in the past that newborns don't have the same status as older children. And then Maggie Little, who we're going to be reading, was in the middle. She's a phenomenal philosopher at Georgetown. I actually know her personally, but that she's phenomenal. And that's not just my own, you know, because I know her. And she argued for a gradualist view. And you don't see this enunciated very much in moral theory. You see one view here, you know, like the fetus doesn't get status because, you know, it's until it's born. Or, I mean, most people don't fit that. Most people do have a gradualist, an intuition that there is a gradual heightening of moral status from the stage of the embryo until birth. Yes.
Well, I think that I totally agree. I like that because I think if you look at society, right, you don't get to do all these, well, maybe that's a bad argument, but I was going to say you don't get to do all these things. Like, you don't get to vote until a certain state, like, you know, your, I don't know if you call it moral capacity or something, but there's all these things that happen in a gradual fashion.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get even to go to school public school, you know, at a certain point.
Gradual development.
Yeah, of everything, you know, and a gradual, respect for your abilities. I mean, we don't even think people are capable of, like, seeing certain movies at a certain age, but I just sort of, that it just said it makes sense with, like, human development. So you earn, earn is the right word, but it just sort of, as soon as you said that, I thought, well, yeah, I can't drive until a certain age. I can't vote for a certain age.
Right. I mean, we do have gradual development after birth, you know. She's focusing more on the graduality, the gradual growing of status along with the gradual development of the embryo / fetus as time goes by. Now, that's what Roe essentially holds. And I think, I mean, many of us might disagree with certain things about Roe or completely disagree with Roe, but, you know, essentially we've set the line of status as in being able to not be voluntarily killed at viability. So it doesn't, you know, and some people argue it should be pushed back 12 weeks, 14 weeks, or whatever. But I do think our intuitions are that, not are, many people, probably the majority of people in this country, that moral status is gradual, and that an embryo is not the same as a newborn child, and that we do, or a 12-week fetus, or any fetus in utero, we do accord more moral status as time goes by. It's hard, though, to argue that against, like, the George position that the embryo is, you know, has the intrinsic ability to develop into a human being and therefore should be accorded the same full status. Anyway, I'm not solving any big questions here. I mean, I guess my point is I don't see enunciated very often, developed as a moral theory, this gradualist view. You often see the extremes on both sides being bandied about in papers back and forth, but a middle position is not often articulated in any robust ethical way. That's a project that Maggie's working on, and we'll look at some of her work next week. Yes?
Kind of related to this, it seems like almost that moral status can also decline over time, because if you have to race in and save two people from a burning building, would you save the 8-year-old or the 80-year-old? Mm-hmm. And so it kind of leads into rationing and all that. I mean, it's something that happens
well,
over lifetimes.
Well, I think, though, that there is a distinction. I think you're right in terms of what resources, how to allocate our resources, certainly our medical resources. Who is going to get the most benefit from the resource, a young child or an 80-year-old? At the same time, I think that we would not argue that it would be lesser of a wrong to, I think essentially argue that every human being who's been born has the same full moral status in general, that we certainly wouldn't be able to better justify the killing of an 80-year-old versus the killing of a 2-year-old, you know. Now, in rationing, we do have to make those decisions, but it's not so much, I mean, arguably, it's not so much based on the value of that life, but how well the resource is going to be utilized, you know. And therefore, since there has been a longer life, it's not that their life in itself is less valuable, but they'll get more life years by giving it to a younger person, you know. Does that distinction make sense? I feel like I'm kind of rambling, but.
With the gradualist view,
No, I was just thinking, could you argue against that by saying that a moral agent has the obligation to protect someone who will one day be a moral agent at whatever gradual step of their development? And sort of in the same way that you say that adult parents make healthcare decisions on behalf of their children to protect that developing autonomy so that it can develop and flourish, and when they reach that you know, adulthood or the age of majority or whatever, that it doesn't really matter if it's the gradualness itself implies the need to protect the development? Or is that a misunderstanding? Is that a misunderstanding of what you think?
I'm not sure the gradualist view would imply any more than the George view or other views that that there's a need to protect.
Okay.
You know, I mean, well, you could say that obviously the more developed the fetus, the greater the responsibilities toward it, and at some point you can't abort it. And that's what our law says. But I'm not sure it implies a greater degree of protection than other views.
Okay.
I mean, I haven't really thought through that. You might have a point. I just bring up the gradualist view because sometimes I read these articles and I feel like I'm living in a different world because I feel like we get a lot of extremes on either side, and the President's Commission was a very good example of that. The CAS Commission could not come to any agreement. You have very entrenched views on one side, entrenched views on another, and never the two shall meet, you know. In a cynical moment, I would say that. But I think that the majority of people who live in this country would, in some way or shape or form, subscribe to a more gradualist view, that it's not, you know, either the embryo gets no protection or 100% protection, but the moral status we accord it depends on the stage of development. Any comments? I know I'm just repeating myself now. This time of day, I start to like wind down. Mesa?
Mesa, yeah. So even if you are willing to grant that it is gradual and an embryo doesn't have the same status as a person, doesn't that just bring up a new set of questions of what status does it have and what can you do? So just because it's not a person, that doesn't mean you can necessarily destroy it.
Absolutely.
Right? So there's just a whole new set.
And so if we're going to accord quote special respect, what does that mean?
Right, exactly.
You know, one thing it means, I think, is that we don't create embryos many, you know, that the compromise has been that we don't create embryos for the purpose of doing research on them. But, of course, you know, as George says, special respect, I mean, that's incoherent. If you're going to respect something, how can you destroy it? But I do think that there are degrees of respect that we give. We give special respect to cadavers. We give special respect to animals. We give, you know, we don't just willy-nilly treat them as objects. And I think that that's the sense of special respect that some would ascribe to.
I think from, like, reading these articles, and I've done, like, animal research in the past, like, the amount of debate that is going into an embryo versus the amount of regulation that is put into, you know, animal studies and stuff, there, you know, general population has, you know, no real clue, I would say, because there are regulations
as to
animal studies, you know, in person,
as to how much, how little,
how much you can
protect.
Do to them and how much protection they actually have. Because, you know, you get these activists that stand outside of your site, but in reality, you know, you can't ask an animal how much pain you're in, but one would assume that some of these compounds that you're testing on them, they are in pain. So I'd be curious to see if these people would take a step back and, you know, yeah, this embryo debate is important, but
how do they feel about it?
How do you
research?
Feel about animal research? How do you feel about, you know, embryo, like, you know, harvest, you know, implanting eggs in dogs, which I know for a fact is going on, and studying, you know, different compounds on the effects of the embryo, which you need to do for women if they are going to take a certain compound during gestation, but what is going to happen there? So, you know, opening this box of defining what status or moral status this embryo is going to have is kind of like a Pandora's box of...
Well, we do have to make those decisions,
yeah,
as a culture.
As a
what
culture.
What status do animals have? What status do fetuses have? Embryos? PBS patients?
everything.
Yeah. And people take the gradual view there because there are vegans who won't eat anything and vegans see animal, right? I mean,
well, that, I would call that a continuum of views. You know, that's different from gradualist view that I'm describing.
I was just going to say that, human, like, embryos, are they human? We are human. So, like, they're a special case because they're especially relevant to us. Whereas when animal research, it's sort of, if the benefit we can get out of them, if it doesn't cross some terribly brutal threshold, if we can get something truly great out of them, then maybe that would justify increasing levels of harm or risk or things like that. Whereas embryos, I mean, there's still that escalation sort of thing, but it's so much more personal because they are, if they are human, if they are have personhood and all that, then, I mean, that's what we are. I feel like that's why it's so much more personal.
But that doesn't mean that we don't give animals any more status. We do.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to see the juxtaposition of the view that humans have exceptional moral status and animals have some versus Peter Singer, who would say, that's not okay, you know. And some people argue that Singer doesn't have enough concern about human status and too much concern about animal status, and he would argue the opposite, the other side. So in that respect, there is a gradualist view in terms of these levels of moral status that Nelson talks about, you know, moral agents, a human community, life and sentience, ecological importance. Were there any other comments? Well, thanks for a good discussion. And, next week, I forgot to remind our other members, is a colloquium. You are not required to come to it, but we're not supposed to have class on colloquium days. So, on a day when there is one. So, there is a colloquium. It's on narrating. It's on narrative ethics, narrative medicine. The title is in your syllabus. And that there's a reception at 4:00 and class starts at 4:00. The colloquium starts at 4:30. Yes.
Oh, I was just checking to see if it was on Wednesday or on another day.
The colloquium?
Yeah.
The colloquium is all Wednesday. That's why we're not having class because it's Wednesday. So we'll meet in 2 weeks to discuss abortion issues.
Yay.
Should be lively.
This should be interesting.
I actually. Okay, I'm just gonna wait. Now I'm gonna wait.
Now you're gonna wait until that shut off.
Yes. I think I'm totally confused then. So.
As we all are.
So what is gradual? Is it only to do with the embryo?
Right. Because I mean, when I explain it, I'm talking about the embryo. I'm saying that we tend to an embryo, fetus, older fetus, newborn, that we tend to, in that context, accord status depend upon stage of development. I mean, I think that those are our moral intuitions. It's hard to phrase those into a moral theory, but.
Okay.
So we don't see an embryo. I'm saying we. I don't mean all of us. Many of us do, but many people don't see an embryo as having the same status because it's not at the same stage of
development.
It's a conscious cell versus a fully formed fetus.
Right. Can you then make that argument with, like, generally we as people, a lot of people take that view, right? That it's stages of development. Can you take that? Can you take that further into saying that? Will that tell us something? What I was saying, maybe I didn't have any.
Well, I think what your example was gradualism in a different context. It's how much moral agency we ascribe to human beings depending on their stage of development. So a child doesn't have the same level of moral agency as an adult because they're not. But that doesn't mean
moral agency. Yeah,
that doesn't mean we give them the
moral
status. You know what I'm saying?
So moral agency is different from moral
yes.
status.
Yes, a moral agent is a person who is able to make choices and act in the world, or has the potential to after they're born, I would say. Moral status is what kind of protections we afford a being based on its moral status.